You're listening to the Inspire Excellence Podcast, recorded at the BVA headquarters with your hosts, Bill Whitaker and Tommy Alquist. Bill is the former CEO of the J.R. Simplot Company and is now a full-time adventure seeker and philanthropist. Tommy is the CEO of BVA Development, co-founder of Crush the Curve Idaho, and most importantly, a full-time grandfather. Each episode focuses on sharing the stories of individuals who are changing the world.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Inspire Excellence with my co-host, Bill Whitaker. We are super excited for this one, Bill. We've been waiting a while. We have Lisa Groh, CEO of Idaho Power with us. And Bill, I'm going to let you start off. Give us a little introduction to Lisa, because I know you are good friends and have known her for a while and speak so highly of her. I'll let you do a little intro and we'll get rolling.
Well, I'm going to be really fair to her. I think she's absolutely spectacular, and we've gotten to be friends over the years. And in fact, I get a little bit of a kick out of when we're in St. Luke's board meetings together. We've texted a few times across the boardroom, and it's always kind of a little bit of humor and a little bit of hey, we need to talk about this. One of the things that I've been really impressed with is the way Lisa's come up through Idaho Power and the way she's made kind of her career work in literally all aspects of Idaho Power. But the thing that I carry away from Lisa more than anything is her absolutely specific concern about worker safety, employee safety. And she's the same way with patient safety and employee safety in the hospital system. And I think that's really an important part of it. And I'd really like for her to talk a little bit about that today. So, Lisa, if we started off today, talk a little bit about how your career from the University of Idaho all the way to being the CEO of Idaho Power.
Well,
you don't have to give us everything.
I won't. I'll spare you from that. Yeah. So thank you so much for the invitation and for such a kind introduction. And although now, you know, we're going to get caught, passing notes in class. So, you know. Right. Exactly. No, it's just been such an honor to get to know you over the years. And Tommy, I don't know where you get your energy from, but it just seems like you are sort of this force of nature. And I have such deep respect for everything that you're doing as well. But so, I never thought I would work for Idaho Power because my grandfather worked as a lineman for 30 years. So it was really, he died when I was in the second grade. So I just remember in that, little short period of my life, he'd get the call and have to go out, something happened. So he had to leave dinner, those kinds of things. I'd visit him. And so it just seemed like it was a very, that's where grandpas worked, right? I literally said old men and dusty equipment at one point. And so I think the universe will absolutely humble you when you think you're never going to do something. It seems to guide you exactly to that place. And so when I went to the University of Idaho, well, actually, let me go back just a little further because I want to make sure that I highlight how important education is. So being a woman, and back then I was a girl and I was going to Fairmont Junior High School, and I really loved math and science, just loved it. And I just never actually knew that I wasn't supposed to. I don't think that's true, but when people say, oh, that's so unusual, I didn't know it was. So one day I was walking down the hall and our guidance counselor, Dr. Goodmanson, pulled me over and said, hey, have you ever thought about what you want to be when you grow up? And I think I was in maybe the eighth grade or something. And I said, no, not really. And he said, you're a young woman. You're really good in math and science. You ought to think about engineering because you can work in any industry. You can make good money and you can live anywhere in the world. And I thought, well, that sounds pretty good. And so that seed got planted by just that interaction, somebody taking notice and giving me that vision, that possibility. So Then you think about my grandfather. I was always super curious. So I would sit in his shop, and he was one of those guys. He was an engineer without training. He came from South Dakota back in the 1930s, and I never really understood why. I never asked the question why they stopped here, but he had a long career here. Super curious. He kind of had a real role in getting television repeater stations stood up. He loved electronics. He would buy stuff and take it apart and put it back together and make it better. And I remember being in a shop when he would do that. So I kind of had those two things going for me, just sort of a natural curiosity, sort of an affinity and for, you know, gadgets and learning. And then I had this sort of coaching and mentorship. So I went to University of Idaho, mostly because it was the best engineering school that I could afford. And so I didn't realize what a world-class education I would get in engineering at University of Idaho. So I go up there and still thought it would be like small signals. Personal computers were just starting. It was fascinating. I thought I was going to Silicon Valley because that was just getting started. So this was in the kind of mid to late 80s. So that's where I thought I was going for sure. And then my senior design project, Idaho Power, came up. It's where the universe intervenes. And they had a senior design project. And it was a team-based project. And that just sounded more interesting. I spent plenty of time in the lab by myself. And it seemed, you know, like that just interested me. And they were working on a computer system application. So I thought, well, that's interesting too. So I signed up. We did the thing. We got a good grade, just FYI. And so then when I came back to Boise, before I went on to move to California, Idaho Power asked if I wanted to come and install the system. And I thought, well, yeah, I could do that before I go off to Silicon Valley. And so I did that. And while I was there for that summer, a job opened up and it was in communications. And I thought, well, yeah, I guess I could do that for a little while until I figure out what I really want to do. And the rest is history. I fell in love with the people of Idaho Power. I fell in love with the mission of Idaho Power. It just really, really aligned with my core values. And I do think it somehow got into my DNA. And then when I got here, I was the second woman ever hired as an engineer. The first one is a dear friend of mine named Colleen Ramsey. So she had broken a lot of ground for me. And then I would say, you know, as I still was, I'm very driven by curiosity. And so I moved around quite a bit. I think this is my 14th job at Idaho Power in almost 34 years. And so a lot of engineering, How does this work? It was always, well, I did this job and these guys are my customers. Well, what do they do? And it just sort of went like that. And it's been this wonderful, wonderful career. And it's really driven by, passion for taking care of people, honestly, a passion for service. And then the values of Idaho Power align with mine. Again, safety being a value, integrity and respect. And so it just really, and it's so vibrant and changing and so much going on with technology that it just sort of ticks all the boxes for me. The other thing that I will say is that I had a tremendous amount of really what I call enlightened men, because there weren't a lot of women role models. And so I did have to break my own ground in a lot of areas. And there were so many men that really reached out and helped me and saw things in me I didn't see in myself. Sometimes it was some tough love conversations. Sometimes it was, you know, picking me up and dusting me off. But they really believed in me and they really helped me believe in myself. So never doubt the importance of mentorship and guidance and really seeing someone realize their potential. And I never, ever imagined I would become the CEO. I was just so happy to do what I was doing and just seemed like one thing sort of led to another. And I am so incredibly honored and humbled and proud to serve in this role and serve the 2,000 people of Idaho Power and the just such incredibly important work that we do. And, you know, I'll talk about my timing is everything, right? It's to step into this role in the middle of a pandemic. I said that I think there's always silver linings, right? Our previous CEO, Daryl Anderson, is just so awesome. So I was explaining to my board, I was sort of happy about the pandemic because it kind of cleared the slate because I didn't have to think about how Daryl would have run the company during the pandemic. So I felt like that was sort of an opportunity. But I do stand on the shoulders of giants like him and many others. And so, you know, getting us through all of us, it wasn't just me, but leading through this pandemic and making sure that we were continuing to provide such a critical service. You know, I'll tell you, both of my daughters are frontline healthcare workers. One is in ICU. One is now in the emergency department at St. Al's. And ironically, I know me being on the board at St. Luke's, but they, you know, such a fine organization. And I thought being the mother of a goalie, in my oldest daughter was a goalie, I thought that was nerve-wracking. Being a flyer in cheerleading was nerve-wracking. Nope, nothing is as nerve-wracking as having two of your fierce, beautiful daughters on the front lines fighting this beast. And and so anyway, how about
unbelievable. So, hey, Tommy, real quickly. So you and I would have a lot of mutual friends at Idaho Power. Lisa and I have a lot of mutual friends at Idaho Power, of course. And the respect that she carries, and it's not just as being the new CEO over the last, year or so. But it's really, it's really about the way she came through the organization and that she learned the organization from the ground up, and the respect that she carries is almost unbelievable. Have you ever climbed a pole?
You know, I haven't. I would love to. I'm just terrified. It's put it out there. I been in a bucket, but not climbed a pole. And I have such respect for those that do.
Well, I do too. But hey, and one other point is I mean, they come from a family of service providers. Her husband, actually, who I just think is fantastic, and he was a fireman. And he's a retired fireman now, I believe. I don't think he's gone back to work. But he's been a fireman his whole career. And I admire that type of service perspective. From a family, nurses and firemen and power company. It's a big deal to me.
Well, thank you. We like to say we run towards trouble.
Yeah,
that's good.
That's right.
Hey, one of the things before we move on, I just think is fantastic is when you tell your story. I have a really good friend of mine who's also one of my, I just look up to this person so much and they've helped me so much in my life. But they have this line when they meet someone and they start hearing their story, they'll say, "Who was the one person for you?" And it's interesting how many times it's not, maybe not one person, but I love the fact that you're talking about your teacher was maybe one of those one persons and how it's such a part of your story. And then before this friend of mine leaves that conversation, he oftentimes says, reminds them, "Hey, go be that one person for somebody else." And I just thought that was incredible as I'm listening to your story, thinking, I'll bet you, Lisa, knowing you, and I don't know you as well as Bill, but your reputation, I'm sure you have been that one person for so many people at Idaho Power and in the community where you've inspired them. I just love that giving back mentality. And I know that's part of the Idaho Power values, knowing Daryl well, and just knowing how you operate. You know, there was a little joke on the campaign trail, though, that we're the only state named after a power company.
Oh, yeah, that one. Yeah, and I always point out that we're the last man standing when that comes to, or the last person standing, because there was Montana Power, there was Washington Water Power, you know, there was all these others, and through sort of different industry changes, they either got bought or changed or whatever, and we stayed true to who we are. And we are a really, really important part of Idaho Power history. If you track back how important being able to pump water out of the Snake River and onto arid, you know, desert landscape to become an agricultural state, we wear that with pride.
I'll tell you one of my highlights. Yeah. I would do it, Bill. I've never told you this story, but I had a company that I had for 18 years, and actually just sold it 2 years ago. But we put AEDs around the country in lots of different places, and we worked with Idaho Power. And as part of that, I got to go down to the dams in Hell's Canyon with one of your crews. And I got to spend 3 days doing some training down there. And I actually stayed in that little cafe you have that takes care of everybody. And all the pictures on the wall and seeing when it flooded and how the community came together. And I got to meet generations of Idaho Power employees there in those 2 days. And then I got to go tour those dams. And I'm telling you, you walk away from that experience. I remember calling my wife. I called all my friends. I said, you think of what happened in this country over a relatively short period of time, the science, the industry that happened to create the infrastructure that has allowed us to thrive as a state, as a country. It is a storied company that is so rich in tradition and built on this incredible value system. It was awesome. So it's one of my highlights, and I tell the story all the time because it truly, I would go back in a heartbeat because for 2 days, I was taking pictures of pictures. I was talking, and the cooks, I'll never forget the cook in the little, she's probably still there. I sat probably for 4 hours and just had her tell me story after story. And it's a little bit of my heritage. My family all came from copper mines down in Utah.
Okay.
And they lived in a copper mine town. That's where they all lived. It was Garfield, Utah, and it's since become a ghost town, but it was the community and everyone worked there. And it really resonated with a lot of my background. But anyway, hey, Lisa, moving on a little bit before we start asking you some really hard questions, because Bill has some really hard ones for you today.
I would expect that.
One thing we ask a lot of our guests, if you were to give advice to someone, a young leader or someone out there that's looking at their future ahead of them, there was a lot probably of tidbits in what you already said in your intro, but what would be the one lesson you'd tell them?
Can I have two?
Absolutely.
I think the first is really understand your business. Because, you know, when you're leading, you are... You know, there's a reason your business exists, and it's really important to understand how that works. But the second one that it has sort of been my unexpected lesson, because I am an engineer. I am so left-brained. And it took me a while to sort of figure this out, that in the end, business is about people. And it's whether you're thinking about your employees, whether you're thinking about your customers, whether you're thinking about other stakeholders in our case, or regulators. We're an investor-owned utility, so we have investors, and they're all humans, and they all have a need, I guess. And I think it's so important, especially as a leader, to really pay attention to your employees, what they need, how they're doing, and what I tell, I speak often in our intro to leadership training, and I say, you know, it's so important that you love them, that you genuinely care about them. You may not always like them on a given day. It's not that they're, you know, you won't get frustrated, but having that really deep sense of connection and you know, I know love sounds kind of freaks people out, but that is how I feel about our company and our employees. And, you know, there's nothing I wouldn't do for them because I believe in what they are doing. I believe in the mission of the company. So I think it's just remembering that it is a very human experience. Yep. We get held to all kinds of metrics and statistics and earnings and all of those things. But you do that through people.
That, Bill, just drop the mic, shut the podcast down.
Yeah, I know.
Honestly,
it's all over.
Just stop it. Well, this is
it's
our
all
last.
Over.
Thank you for joining us. This is our last episode.
Yeah.
No, Lisa, that was fantastic. Wow.
Okay, Lisa, lightning round.
I'm ready.
Okay, and Tommy, we'll both do this. But first of all, you come in, new CEO. Pandemic rages a year ago. You talked about, you know, kind of clearing the decks, you know, because it changed everything from when Daryl, you know, just left, you know, just literally a few months before. What happened when you went to these outdoor workers, these linemen, and said, hey, we're going to have to be careful. We're going to wear masks. We're going, you know, when we're around each other, we're going to wear masks when we're with our customer. And you're the new person on the block. And we didn't totally understand the pandemic at first. And you not only had to influence, but you had to make sure that they were accountable to your desires. How did that work?
So, yeah, that, when I think back to those early, you know, it was like almost a year ago to this day.
And, yeah.
You know, we didn't, to your point, we didn't know much about this other than it was killing people. It was super scary. There's no cure. There's no vaccine. There's nothing. And I remember thinking, you know, I was terrified. I thought, are we going to lose people? Are people going to die from this? And I didn't know what kind of death this was. It was one of those terrible diseases where your organs liquefy and you bleed out your eyes. I mean, what is it, like the worst possible scenario? Where are we going? And so remember, safety is a value for Idaho Power. And so that's the lens that I looked through. I wanted to get us to the safest possible operating mode as quickly as possible. And I even told my team, my goal is for everybody to say, wow, did they overreact? This was no big deal. And not that it's no big deal, but that we don't get why, because we're still here and everything's good.
Right.
So I kept watching, I kept reading EEI, which is the Edison Electric Institute. Daryl and I were actually back there when this whole thing was breaking, and we were listening to Dr. Rebecca Katz from, I think, Georgetown, that was on site telling us all about, you know, what's coming. And he and I were kind of looking at each other like, oh, crap, you know, we better start thinking about this. So we definitely have a very, you know, we have this, the spectrum when it comes to beliefs in our company. We are sort of a reflection of the communities we serve. So we had some that were terrified and didn't want to ever come back, and we're still, you know, may have to pry them out of their homes to come back. We had those that don't believe it. This is silly, all the things. So we really came together as a leadership team. And I remember the day where we had a conference call with the executives, and I just said, listen, this is getting worse, not better. And I know we were in all kinds of planning modes. We had only had 50 people online remotely at the same time before this happened, 50. And we had 1,000 that we were going to be sending home. So we were doing load testing as fast as we could. I think we had maybe 200 on Friday, and we sent everyone home that could go home on Monday. And our IT department, God bless them, they showed up, and they, within, you know, 48 hours, had mostly everybody up and running. And, you know, it kind of felt like the Lehman Brothers, you know, everyone was just carrying stuff out of their office and going to their cars. It was just crazy. And we just asked everyone to just, we don't know what exactly we're doing here, just work with us. And they did. Now, the field, you know, they were saying, well, you know, we don't need to wear masks, you know, we're not coming inside. And so there was a lot of pushback up front. And then we really brought in leadership from the field and said, how can we make this work? So we don't have to have heavy-handed edicts that, you know, we have a very proud company. And when we aren't thoughtful and we don't ask for their input, oftentimes they will either A, do exactly what you asked, which is often not the right thing, or they will just full on, you know, push back, and then it becomes, you know, a really difficult and it breaks down communication. So we brought folks in and said, how should we do this? And they gave great feedback. For example, we broke everybody up into pods in the field so that there wasn't a lot of, you know, interaction between big groups. Now, when you have a big blowdown or storm that blows through, you know, there's not always a way to do that. But they did mind the, you know, we got them, we did get them masks, we got them hand sanitizer, we put them in individual trucks so they weren't together too often. And, you know, all of that has worked because we've only had 174 cases out of 2,000 people in the last year, at least that we know of. And so we made all kinds of, you know, I guess when you go back to my engineering brain, I was like, we got to have rules and we got to have it all the same and we got to do this and that. And literally that lasted maybe an hour. And then we started getting this feedback and I was thinking, oh my gosh, we've got to meet people where they are and we have to be flexible and we have to listen and we got to figure this out together. And I found that when we gave some agency to the employees to help us figure out how to do this, it didn't have to be all the same. They came up with much better ideas than we probably would have because they were on the ground and experiencing things that we weren't. And I think it helped them feel more in control when in a situation that felt just completely out of control.
Yeah, it's really fantastic to feel it come from the troops or from ground level where you don't have to mandate. Because I can imagine that all of a sudden, new CEO, I don't want to play the woman card, but woman CEO, and now they know you, and they know that you earned your stripes. But the real reality is, and you say, okay, you big burly guys out there in the field, you're going to be masking up and using hand sanitizer. And I can imagine, and if you did that as a mandate, there'd be a little bit like, what the hell is going on here? And by the way, you know, the little lady in the CEO's office. And so, and I know that that's not the way you did it. And I know it was effective. And what I really know is the customers all got serviced. And I don't think you ever had an interruption of service in the entire, I'm sure you
did. We were 99.9% last year.
Were you really? No,
which
kidding.
Is not atypical, honestly. Mother Nature
fantastic.
Was pretty kind to us as well. We didn't get pummeled. We had a really, really terrible storm, like in early summer. But beyond that, it's been decent. So a lot of that has been system hardening over time as well. But thank you for that. And I, you know, I got some really wise advice from one of our board members. Her name is Judy Johansson, and she's just a rock star. And she said, Lisa, as your tenure as a CEO, try not to make more than 5 or 6 decisions that you have to, you know, make a decision. And so I was
That's
always
great.
Sort of saying, is this one of them? Is this one of them? So certainly I will express my opinion. Certainly, you know, I will try to give as much good information as I can, but I have just found that leading through leaders and again, letting people have input and agency over how it impacts their lives is just such a better way to go about it.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, Lisa, I know one of Bill's tough questions, but I'm going to do the intro on it. Congressman Simpson's proposal. So I'm going to give you a little 30-second story that's going to make you laugh. So I'm on the campaign trail, and it was a brutal experience, and I'll never do it again, by the way.
Oh.
But you get prepped for all these forums that you're in, and I'm in a forum, and it's with all of the sportsmen. And I don't know, I'll tell you what, you say it's just fish, but those fish lead to livelihoods. And if you think of like what rural Idaho used to be when you had fish population, there is a compelling argument from a lot of people on industry and what it could mean for the state and all of that. So I'm in a forum, here's the short part of it. And I get asked a question, and I went back and reviewed it 100 times because the question was just this. It said, hey, if the science behind this, if it made sense, right, would you be willing, if you won, to review the science behind breaching these Lower Snake River dams? That was the question. And I'm sitting there, and you know they're trying to get you, and I'm thinking, they just asked me if I'd review the science behind it. Of course I'd review the science. So I very quickly said, yeah, I would want to see all the data that has to do with both sides of this argument. And of course I would. So I answer the question. I get done. I walk off stage. And my campaign manager about killed me. Honestly, it's the biggest fight we've ever been in. He says, you might be the dumbest human being on planet Earth. I can't believe you answered it that way. And he literally walked out on me. He's like, I'm going to spend the next 3 weeks cleaning up this mess. And he was right. That one comment created such a crap storm for me because I said I would listen to the science behind this.
God forbid we start doing that. Yeah.
But I'm telling you, this is an emotionally charged thing. Like nothing. I learned a lesson then, and I actually am a little embarrassed. He wrote an op-ed we put in the paper all across the state the next week saying, I made a big mistake. I won't listen to science. We're never breaching these damn dams no matter what happens. And it went out because it's a big deal. It's emotional. And I think this is why it's so emotional. People spent so much time creating dams for energy and water and irrigation that the idea of ever breaching anything anywhere on planet Earth just doesn't sit well with them. That's one. Two, no matter how productive, because then I went and studied how much these dams are actually used for power downstream, and they're really, you know more than I do, but it's not a ton, but there is some use of it. But I think, I just think that inherently this idea of taking something away in a regulatory environment, which you can never put a dam in anymore because of the regulations that are up, it strikes a nerve with Idahoans that are ranchers and farmers and conservative folks. And on the other side of it, you have the same conservative people that are saying, hey, we got to look at this. How do you balance that, Lisa? My goodness, this is like the craziest thing ever. And you're in the middle of it because you're Idaho Power.
Right. Well, you know, it is a very, very complicated problem. And you know, there's also the Idahoans whose livelihoods would be impacted because of what would happen to the Port of Lewiston. And there's, the list of people that would be impacted is huge. And there are, but to your point, there are people that are impacted with the status quo. And so my initial reaction was recoil on, oh, heck no, why would you ever, ever take out such a important resource? And we all want to have clean portfolios. Why would you get rid of hydro? So there is elements of that, but here's the reality. Remember, part of this bill actually is to help fix Bonneville because they are not going to be solvent in the future, the near future, if something isn't done. So there is that element of it. And remember that the federal hydro system, the federal Bonneville system, is owned by all of us. And then, you know, the death by a thousand cuts, all the individual lawsuits that just continue to come, and anytime there is one, it seems like that the hydro industry loses something as a result. Either customers have to pay more, or there's, you know, operations are impacted, which has cost billions of dollars. The fish that are there have to be some of the most expensive fish in the world, honestly. So as they've worked through all this, I don't know if this is too big to succeed, in contrast, too big to fail, because it is so big. But when you think about it, you know, $38 billion is a lot of money. But if it was able to solve this once and for all, so we stopped with the death by a thousand lawsuits, and there's some concern that just more and more lawsuits are going to keep coming. And so could we look at this comprehensively rather than through the knothole of each lawsuit and each constituent that has a, you know, their issue? And so it brings, if nothing else, it is bringing forth a really good conversation about it rather than just the, you know, get rid of them or no, we'll never talk about it. I don't think there's anyone in our industry that is for dam breaching, but I'm for solving this problem. And so if it means that something has to give, you know, I always believe that our democracy, not to get too high level here, is built on compromise. And so is there a way? Is there a way? And so I applaud the work that he's doing, bringing so many people together to have the dialogue. And if there was a way to compensate people that are impacted in a way they thought was fair, and that so they could adjust to the new world, I don't see how that is necessarily a bad thing in and of itself. And so I'm cautiously optimistic, or maybe I'm just fascinated to see what comes next. And so we're watching it closely. You know, certainly it's easy to talk about dams over there. I wouldn't want it to come upstream and start talking about breaching our dams. But the way it's constructed, I think it would kind of put some guide, you know, sort of ring fence the issues so that we can get past this and move on. So I will be fascinated to see where it goes.
Hey, Bill, I know you have something to say, but what you just said for me, when I heard it, I don't know. It's so complicated. I mean, it's just so complicated. But what I loved about it immediately and my knee jerk was, hey, at least people are going to be listened to. I think that there's a lot to be said for Mike Simpson and the fact that, hey, this is bold. It's big, probably too big to succeed, I think is what you said. But hey, there's a lot of people that are going to be listened to. And this notion that, hey, at least we're going to have one deep dive into the science and the financial impact and what this could mean. Gosh, I think that's never a bad thing, listening to people, even if it ends up being just a listening session and you were listened to, but hey, it's not going to work. So, hey, that was a fantastic answer. Thank you. I love that.
You know, it's absolutely fantastic. At the same time, Lisa, how much power does Idaho Power use from hydro?
Well,
percentage wise, can you talk to that?
It's usually somewhere, last year it was a little less. We're kind of in the big renovation of all of our hydro, or essentially getting rebuilt. And so between outages and whatnot, we were just over 40% of the portfolio was hydro, but it can be as high as 60%.
Hmm. Oh, really? So how do you replace that?
Replace.
Replace hydropower.
Well, I think, Bill, where these dams are, if you look at the statistics through Bonneville, at least this a few years ago that I dove deep in, it might not. It's not as much, because I remember the percentage of what they use over, because that power goes over to the coast, right, to the Seattle area.
So you have to be careful of the numbers that you examine. So I'm going to tie kind of two things together here. So, you know, when you look at averages, that isn't necessarily how we keep the lights on. We have to have enough power to serve the peak load, the worst it is, the most power everybody uses. For us, it's in the summer. Our super peak is when agriculture and air conditioning coincide, usually late June, early July. And so we need all of that. And we, you know, and so I do believe that power has to be replaced. Now, what it gets replaced with, the thing about hydro, it's highly dispatchable. You know, it has storage with what those that have reservoirs, and it doesn't emit, and so it has these characteristics that are really hard to replace. And a lot of studies have been done that as we go through this clean transition, that gas, it right now is the thing that sort of operates like that. Now, what I'm excited about is the possibility of hydrogen being able to replace gas, and we can reuse the infrastructure. I'll set that one aside for a moment. But if we look back at what happened in Texas, when you don't have enough resources to serve your load in that max moment. Now, I could point to California last summer. These are real situations where you have to be mindful. When it goes bad, it goes really bad. And it's usually where there's intense weather on top of it. So the notion that we can just get rid of resources and we would be fine sort of on average, I don't think is true. So something, whether it's solar and storage, whether it's gas or renewable gas, small nuclear reactors. I don't know what Bonneville would choose to replace it with, but I do believe they would have to replace something.
Well, and it all goes into a grid that we all function
right
off of.
Right.
Right. That's kind of a bank that we need to FDIC the bank or whatever.
Right.
I'm assuming.
And make sure that as we do a lot of regional planning, obviously we each have an individual obligation to make sure that we have enough, but we're really looking hard as an industry, it's resource adequacy is what we call it, to make sure that we're not all hoping everybody else has something we can buy, you know, when we need it. So we've got to really look hard at this, because as we transition to clean, intermittency of some of the new generators causes a real problem. We can't forget this is one big machine that we all have to operate, and that the more sort of, it doesn't like big swings. The machine does not like to be swung around, and some of that intermittence actually happens. And so those good base load resources that we can, you know, generally depend on. Now, if you look at Texas, yep, a lot of gas plants and other things froze up too. That was just an extreme situation. But my point just being that we don't ever want to get caught short. So I am always very sensitive about taking baseload off. And, you know, we're on our clean today, cleaner tomorrow path, taking coal, which I think is the right thing to do. But we're very concerned about how we go about that so that we never get caught short, that we're reliable and resilient. So those are not the same thing. One is trying to prevent outages from happening. The other is recovering when they do. And it's going to take some new technology, some new ways to think and operate as we make this transition. And these are real life examples that we cannot miss the lessons of, because could it happen here? Certainly we're much better prepared for cold weather, and, you know, we've done a lot of things to prepare for wildfires, but yes, those kinds of situations could happen here, and we do everything we can to be ready for it. But one of them is not, you know, when you look at deregulation, for example, in the ERCOT situation, just where everyone is kind of doing their own thing to their own profit, equation, that can get really messy, really hard. I don't think the invisible hand of the economy necessarily works quite as well for electricity. I do believe in the regulated monopoly model because we are here long term, and the price signals of $9,000 per megawatt hour isn't long enough in duration to really send a signal to that invisible hand to invest, and that's where they found themselves. So it is a very good lesson. And my sister lives in Houston, so I was there on a ringside seat. It was terrible, just terrible. And the compounding things of that.
So Lisa, did Idaho Power have learnings off of the Houston, Texas mess? So were there learnings that you all needed to absorb?
What we did is we went back and because I immediately asked that question because I knew our regulators were going to be saying, okay, well, how are you guys positioned? So we went back to every single operating unit in this company and said, where are we exposed? What are you worried about? And we've learned lessons over time. For example, this is probably 20 years ago, but we didn't have heaters on the gas that powers the breakers. And we had a really cold snap and we couldn't operate our breakers. And that was a big problem. So we now have heaters on them that are battery operated. And so yes, we learn as we go. Now, we have been really, I feel like Idaho especially has been really helpful, for example, in our wildfire mitigation, where we're able to clear around vegetation away from our poles in a 20-foot sort of circle with long-term herbicide, which I know some people don't like. But man, you see those wildfires come through and our poles are standing in the middle of a big white disc because they burn fast and they burn through and our lines are still standing. So things like that are really important. And so when we watch the California fires, you know, those terrible tragedies, we have a new plan for tree trimming, which we already do, but we're enhancing in certain areas, different kinds of equipment that we can, fuses that don't emit sparks when they operate. And so we're looking at that. The situation in Texas, an interesting point is El Paso is actually connected to the Western interconnection, of which we're a part, not ERCOT. It was just too expensive. They're too far away from the ERCOT grid, so they connected to something that was closer to them. They survived just fine. So that interconnection is really, really important. And I'm fascinated to see what Texas will do as a result. They have very, very weak ties to the rest of the Western interconnection or any other interconnection for that matter. So we see how important transmission is. We see how important some of the projects we're working on, like Boardman to Hemingway, why that helps both Idaho and the region to have those strong ties so we can move things around is critical, not just for, you know, extreme weather, but just for that clean future to be able to move things around. So lessons will continue to come. And of course, there's always knee-jerk policy. I don't know if I've told you this, Bill, but I just joined the Federal Reserve board in the Salt Lake branch. And I brought this up to them that, you know, they always ask us, is there anything we should be worried about? And I said, not to have a knee-jerk reaction and impose policy that's really expensive and doesn't do anything. You know, really, let's diagnose what the problems are, and yes, let's learn from them, and yes, we will invest where we need to, but don't just have everyone panic and then just say, well, you got to do all these things. We've been to that one before, and it's been a lot of wasted effort. So that's kind of how we learn and how our industry just shares so much because we're sort of in regulated monopolies. Yeah, we're kind of competitors, but man, we are open books when it comes to how to keep the interconnection safe, because that's what we all rely on.
That is super. So Tommy was, I told you that Lisa's one of the most impressive people I know. And at the same time, I could do this with Lisa for a long time. I know you could too.
Lisa, this has just been fantastic. This has just been so good.
Yeah.
We can't thank you enough for coming on. And also just sincerely, thank you and Idaho Power for what you do in our community always. No matter what the need is, no matter what the social safety net issue is in our community, you're always there leading the way. And we just can't thank you enough for what you individually and what the company collectively means to Idaho and to our community and to everything that happens here. We've got to have you come back, because I didn't even get to my list, Bill, because this is so good. And I know the people listening are going to be just over the moon with what you've been able to share with us today. So thank you very, very much. Bill, final words?
You know, honestly, Lisa, real quickly, this is called Inspire Excellence, and I can assure you this is inspirational, I think, for anybody that's listening to it. And thanks for your time today.
Such an honor. I can't wait to see you again soon, hopefully. Right?
Yeah, we will. We will.
Good.
For sure.
Okay. You guys, in the meantime, stay safe.
Thank you. And everyone joining us today, thanks for joining our Inspire Excellence podcast. Go out and find someone to uplift or serve, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Inspire Excellence podcast. We hope you've heard something today that will inspire you to make a difference in the world. Join us again for our next episode.